Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half here on the programme as part of Faith Explored every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio that brings different perspectives together for dialogue and debate. And we're doing something very different on today's programme. I'll explain why. We're doing a Devil's Advocate show in a moment's time and who my guests are. But if you're unfamiliar with Unbelievable, why not go and make yourself a bit more familiar by visiting the webpage premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can explore past shows, loads of different topics and guests that we've had on over the years. You can find the podcast, you can find videos, blogs, features and much more. And don't forget that very soon in February we'll be adding details of Unbelievable, the conference 2016 taking place on the 2nd of July. Later on today's programme, you'll be hearing some feedback to last week's show, feisty debate on whether gay marriage is good or bad for children. So we'll be hearing what you had to say about that. And later on today, if you're listening to The Profile between 4 and 5, then you'll hear Sam Hale speaking to author Amy Boucher Pye about being an American settling down in the UK, an experience she describes in her latest book. So lots to look forward to this Saturday afternoon. Hope you enjoy today's show. Let me tell you what we're talking about today.
You're unbelievable.
Well, I've got a really interesting programme for you today. I'm describing it as a devil's advocate show. The reason is that we're getting the traditional binary opposition of a Christian and an atheist to sort of swap roles today. Now, who's on the programme? Michael Roos joins me. He's a philosopher of science at Florida State University. And if you're a regular listener to Unbelievable, he'll be a familiar voice. The author of many books, including Atheism, What Everyone Needs to Know. So he knows what it's talking about when it comes to atheism. But today, he's going to be trying to defend theism. Okay, so the idea is the atheist defends a god, and the Christian defends atheism. And the Christian in this case is Randall Rouser. He's a theologian out at Edmonton in Canada. And he's been on the programme a number of times himself as well. And so these may be familiar names and voices if you're a regular listener, but what they'll be doing is a bit unfamiliar, a bit of an experiment really for the programme today. I'm not really sure quite how it's going to play out, and I'm not sure my guests do either. But in any case, Randall will be attempting to defend atheism, and we'll just see what happens, and we'll make some time at the end of the show to debrief and find out what both my guests made of that. But they're being jolly good sports for coming on to do this on today's programme. So first of all, welcome along Michael and welcome along Randall.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's great to be here again.
Hi Randall, Edmonton. I bet that's a hell of a lot colder than Florida.
Yes, it is. And might I just say that it was we were really sad when you went to Florida a few years ago. It was great having you teaching for years in Canada.
Well, I can tell there's a lot of bonhomie in this show. We're gonna have
some
fun.
There is now,
I'm sure.
But give us 60 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, Randall, coming to you, you were the one who suggested this slightly crazy idea of the role reversal. What are you hoping to get out of it by doing this?
Well, I think a bottom line is if you can't understand the grounds or evidence for an opposing position, I don't think you yet really understand the opposing position, especially in a perennial debate like the existence of God. When I'm in the seminary classroom, I have my apologetics students do debates at the end of the semester, and inevitably one of them has to defend a position they don't accept in reality. Mm. And we often joke that a passerby may be walking by the classroom and hear a student giving a talk on why God doesn't exist, and that would really show it's such a liberal seminary.
Yes, I'm
sure. But the reality is that's an important exercise because it creates a new sense of charity for other people and an appreciation for why they hold the views they do.
I suppose the only danger is you might talk yourself into believing the position you're defending.
Actually, can I interrupt here?
Do.
I couldn't agree more with what Randall is saying. In fact, I've taught philosophy of religion many, many years. I've been teaching for 50 years now. And one of the things I always did was get my students to take the opposite position. Mm. And particularly those who were eager Christians, I would get them to argue up or to write little papers for the other side. I'd say, if God's going to strike anybody dead, he's going to strike me dead. But in fact, God isn't going to strike anybody dead on this one. The only way that you understand the position is to try to put yourself in the other person's boots, as it were. So I'm entirely empathetic to what we're doing.
Yes.
And although I hope it's going to be fun, I think it's very serious at the same time. And, I'm a teacher. Terrific from a pedagogical point of view.
Yes. So I'm sure you'll both give it your very best shot, even though there is a slight strangeness to defending a position you don't actually.
I'm not just going to give it my best shot. I'm going to win.
Excellent. Well,
Randall wants
me to win.
And you might even have a convert on your hands by the end of it, but we'll see. It's a great explanation for why we're doing what we're doing today, then, Randall. And Michael, obviously something you're keen on doing as well. Have either of you in a debate ever actually changed your mind on something? People often ask whether debates have a purpose in this way. I don't know if either of you have ended up changing your minds because of a position that's been argued.
Not in a formal debate, because probably the formal debate, for one thing, sort of militates against that. It's a very constrained, rhetorically loaded forum. But I certainly have changed my position over the years by reading what those that disagree with me say and reflecting on it over time.
Hmm. Michael, can you recall?
I've had very much the same experience. I remember back in the early 1980s, Peter Singer asked me to give a talk in Washington. He was at some think tank for a year. And he asked me to defend sort of evolutionary ethics, and I did. And I came away saying, you know, I don't think there was any contradiction in what I said. Maybe he's right. Maybe it's right. So, yes, the answer to your question is I've certainly had experiences where I've come away really wanting to rethink what I'm doing.
Mm. Well, look, let's get this experiment underway, shall we? And just before we launch into it, I'm just going to say that if you're listening and you'd like to give your thoughts on today's show, you're welcome to send me an email and I'll try and read as many as I can out on next week's show. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us, as usual, at the Facebook and Twitter account. Links to that from the web show as well, the web page, and you can leave comments underneath today's show there too. That's all available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So just to reiterate what we're doing today, we've got Michael Roos, who's an atheist philosopher, and Randall Rouser, who's a Christian theologian, but they're sort of swapping roles. A first time we've ever done this really on Unbelievable, and Michael will be aiming to defend theism, the view that God actually does exist, and our Christian theologian Randall conversely attempting to defend atheism. So why don't we start with you, Randall, making as briefly as you can, but obviously I'll give you a little time to do this, the main points you want to bring to bear and what you think are probably the best arguments for atheism as far as you can see.
Sure. So let me begin by defining what we mean by God. I'm going to say God is a necessarily existent, non-physical agent who is omniscient, omnipotent, and perfectly good. And by perfectly good, I think that includes desiring that all sentient creatures achieve wellness. So then, that said, I'm going to be defending two claims. First of all, the evidence does not support the belief that God exists,
mm-hmm.
nor does the evidence... And I'll actually start with this one. Nor does the evidence support the claim that the God described in the Bible, or that being satisfies the definition given of God.
Mm.
Before I get into that, though, let me just emphasize, I'm defending here a mere theism. Mm. These days, it's very common for atheists to defend a more robust thesis like naturalism or materialism. And I'm not going to be getting into some of those broader debates. So the question of the soul, for example, even something like that, or life after death, those are questions that in principle are consistent with atheism, taking an affirmative view of them. I'm only arguing that God does not exist, mm-hmm. and if he does, he's not the Christian God.
Okay. And where are you going to start with that?
So let's start then with the biblical God. And so this is one that would, I think, take down Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So if we start off by saying God is perfectly good, then we say any being that commands, or condones morally evil actions is not perfectly good. Three, we could say Yahweh commands, and condones morally evil actions. Therefore, Yahweh is not perfectly good. Therefore, Yahweh is not God. So all I need to do is to provide evidence from Scripture that Yahweh commands these kinds of actions. And that's not that hard to do. As Steven Pinker said, the Bible is one long celebration of violence. Just to give a few examples, in 1 Samuel 15, Yahweh explicitly commands the genocide of the Amalekite people, even specifying the destruction of babies. When Saul respares the king, Yahweh's priest, Samuel, angrily cuts him to pieces.
Mm.
Well, Yahweh himself, of course, commits genocide in Genesis by flooding the earth, killing not only all human beings, including infants, the handicapped, mentally and physically, the elderly, but also on all non-marine creatures. And he does so by consigning them to one of the most cruel ways to die, which is drowning. In Ezekiel 16, Yahweh expresses his rage against Israel by calling her a faithful wife, stripping her naked so that her lovers can stone her to death and then hack her to pieces. And only then will Yahweh be satisfied. Joshua 11:20 tells us that God hardened the hearts of the Canaanites so he might slaughter them without mercy. And we could go on and on.
Right. Mm. So all of this kind of comes together for you, if you were arguing, as it were, the case against God, for saying, well, this Yahweh cannot be the God of love and goodness that you have in mind.
Yes, the being that we find in the Scriptures seems to be, as Feuerbach would have put it, a projection of human ideals at the time. And in the ancient Near East, 2,500, 3,000 years ago, it was a brutish, incivil time. And that's the reflection of God we get there. Mm. So if you want to find an understanding of God, you're not going to find it in Western monotheisms.
Okay. And you've got another leg, as it were, to your argument as well against God. What are you going to bring next?
Okay, so the second one is to say, let's look at nature and see whether nature reflects the existence of God. And I'm going to argue it doesn't, that what we find in nature is just indifference to the wellness of sentient creatures. Remember, I tied the love of God into the wellness of sentient creatures.
Hmm.
Now, I'm going to give you an illustration to begin with. Timothy Treadwell was a young Californian who journeyed off to Alaska in search of meaning, and there he started living with Kodiak bears. Well, things were going great until one of those bears ate him.
Mm.
It was a bear that Treadwell filmed only hours before in the deluded belief that it was a friend or a spiritual brother. Later on, Werner Herzog took this footage and he made it into a documentary film. And at one point, he shows footage that Treadwell filmed mere hours before that very bear ate him. And Herzog comments, "What haunts me is that in all the faces of all the bears that Treadwell ever filmed, I discover no kinship, no understanding, no mercy. I see only the overwhelming indifference of nature."
Mm.
And I think likewise, when we look at nature, that's what we find. To take an example, in February 1990, when the space probe Voyager 1, the cameras turned around and it took a photograph of Earth from 6 billion miles away, a tiny blue dot set against an inky black void. Well, in the last half billion years, there have been between 5 and 20 mass extinctions on Earth. Scientists estimate that more than 99.9% of all species that ever lived on Earth have gone extinct, including untold trillions of individual organisms, many of them sentient, some of them self-conscious,
countless numbers of them suffering terribly in the death throes as they succumbed to the blank stare of that indifferent nature.
Mm. Well, that's
and human beings find ourselves in that same predicament. So it seems like the universe itself does not attest to a loving God.
Well, that's eloquently put. And yes,
you, I'm an eloquent guy.
You're a very convincing devil's advocate as well. So maybe before we get to your positive case for theism, Michael, do you want to give us an idea of how you would respond, you know, with a theistic hat on to some of these objections, both that the Yahweh we find in the Bible doesn't seem to match up to the idea of a good God, and that nature itself doesn't seem to reflect the existence of such a God?
I think basically what I want to say is that so much of this strikes me is almost naive in a way. I don't see the world, I don't see God, I don't see religion as something which is just handed to you on a plate, and here it is, it's all absolutely true right from the beginning, and here we go. In other words, I'm not only not a literalist, I don't think that it's a situation like Moses being given the tablets and everything like that. I mean, I see that the world that we live in and the world of humans is much more developmental, even dare I use the word evolutionary. And so I don't expect, for instance, that the God of the ancient Jews, Israelites, necessarily to be the God of Jesus. In fact, I don't expect that. And what I expect to see is much more a kind of evolving and, as it were, coming to understand the way that religion is and our relationship with God and all of these things. I mean, look, but use the analogy of science. Way back when, I mean, as Augustine said, the ancient Jews didn't know about rainbows or anything like that and refraction of light, and no more should they. So things were spoken metaphorically, and then, of course, Augustine knew a great deal more, and we obviously know a great deal more than Augustine in the scientific realm. Now, I don't see why religion necessarily has to be any different. I'm very empathetic to what John Henry Newman said, what was in the book that he wrote just as he was converting to Catholicism and then insisted on the imprimatur, much to his new co-religionists' embarrassment, where he said, I see essential truths, but then, as it were, they have to work themselves out from the original archetype and to develop. So while I accept everything that Randall wants to say, at the same time, I don't see this as something which is necessarily binding on me today. Mm. But I can well say that I stand in this tradition, just as I want to say I stand in the tradition of Plato or Aristotle, and there's important thing. I mean, Aristotle argues for slavery, and yet does this mean that there's nothing in Aristotle which is of any value to us today? Absolutely not. And so this would be very much the kind of developmental, I mean, as I say, let's not even use the word evolutionary because it seems to be a flag in these discussions, but certainly the kind of developmental view I would take to religion, including my own.
Yes. What I'm hearing from you, I suppose, is that if you were to be a Christian, Michael, you'd be arguing alongside probably a slightly more liberal progressive kind of view of God, where there's unfolding of knowledge over time.
And, I think there's two things about Quakers. On the one hand, they don't have dogmas, they don't have priests, they don't have what George Fox calls steeplehouses. And yet at the same time, rather like the Pietists that Kant grew up in, it's an intensely spiritual religion, incredibly powerfully so. And I feel that this is very much the religion I want to defend.
What about the second point, just briefly, that Randall brought there? The bear who had played nicely.
Point. First of all, I didn't notice Jesus dying on the cross for bears.
Mm.
I thought that Jesus died on the cross for you and me, and even for Randall, even for Canadians. I think Canadians are the only people in the world who are not touched by original sin, by the way. That's just too nice. But in any case, no, I mean, the point is, so on the one hand, I want to say that. Why should a bear be anything but indifferent?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't see the world as something which is going to be lovey-dovey and helpful and those sorts of things. I think that Christian faith demands a response in the place of indifference and those sorts of things. I don't think it's a warm, loving world. I think it's a veil of soul-making. Mm. And I think if the world were not at some level indifferent, then it wouldn't work from the Christian perspective. That if every time you got into problems, immediately there was a physical, you know, solution, an angel appeared, rather like, you know, Wonderful Life.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be the Christian world.
Hmm, that's an interesting point. So, and when you talk of soul making, not everyone may be familiar with that shorthand for that. But what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I mean that at some level, that this is a time for us to improve, to develop, to try to become better in some sort of way. And I think I think this is the essence of all the great religions, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism or whatever, that at some level we've got a job of trying to be better at the end than we were at the beginning. So in other words, I'm certainly not with Jonathan Edwards, who thinks that, you know, rather like the Red Queen, you run flat out and you just don't make any movement. I really don't. I think that you can improve. My God, yes. I'm a teacher. If I don't believe that, I shouldn't be in the business. But at the same time, I think that if the world weren't, as I say, at some level indifferent, then the whole point of being a Christian and striving to make the thing better in some way wouldn't be there. As I say, I mean, if Clarence, you know, from Wonderful Life appeared every evening or something like that, it would be a very different sort of world from the world that we've got. The world which is hard, which is cruel, but which, you know, it's the world of Job.
Yes, it's the world in which I suppose...
And we've got, what God wants us to do is to be mensch,
yes,
to fight, you know, to fight it, as it were.
It's the idea, I suppose, that you can't be a generous person unless there is someone who is in need.
Some sort of level like that. I mean, I'm hesitant to say that God made people suffer for my salvation.
No.
I really don't want to say that.
No.
But I do want to say that if the world were a warm, cuddly sort of place, it would be a very different sort of world.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a world where the Christian drama could take place.
Well, you've got me convinced, Michael.
I told you
both doing a good job so far. Well, I must give you now a chance, Michael, to sort of come just describe briefly what your key points would be if you were bringing the defence of theism this time. What do you think are some of the best arguments in favour of
God? Well, I think that obviously the first one is what Heidegger called the fundamental question: why is there something rather than nothing? Now, I know that particularly in the 20th century, a lot of analytic philosophers have followed Wittgenstein by saying that's not a genuine question. I think it is. Mm. I mean, why is there something rather than nothing? Now, you know, that nasty little jumped-up, what's-his-name, Lawrence Krauss. Now I'm sorry, I'm starting to sound like Yahweh rather than like a Christian. But Lawrence Krauss, who incidentally is Canadian-educated, he went to Carleton, wants to say that modern physics explains why is there something rather than nothing. You know, he just shows his ignorance of both philosophy and theology at that point, because the question is not, you know, what was before the Big Bang or something like that. The question is, why is there existence at all? Why is it sustained in some sort of sense? So for me, this is a very fundamental question, and I'm not sure that it necessarily forces. I certainly don't think it necessarily forces you into a Christian God to answer that. Obviously, though, you're going to be pushed towards I think, some form of theism, because note that, say, a religion like Buddhism doesn't, you know, just no more answers that than Richard Dawkins does. Mm, the Buddhism takes existence as a giving, as a given.
Yeah.
As, of course, did, let's say, somebody like Aristotle. Aristotle, you know, thought that the world was eternal. So for Aristotle, why is there something rather than nothing is not a genuine question. But I think it is a genuine question. And I want to say that I think that the idea, I mean, it's what we call abduction in the philosophical trade, that a creator God is in some sense responsible for it, I think makes, you know, not very good sense.
Let me put
it, as I say, I think it really gives us some sort of understanding of what's going on. Now, I think, obviously, you've got to tease out an awful lot more, and I'm not sure that at this point one could say necessarily distinguish between, let's say, Judaism and Christianity and Islam, except, of course, let's be honest about it. I mean, neither the Jews nor the Christians, except perhaps Paul, were into philosophy in the Bible.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that I should look for answers there. But
just,
I do find, why is there something rather than nothing,
is a fundamental, quite a powerful one.
Question, which I think has to be addressed. Now, the other thing, I'm not quite so sure that I want to say the existence of life as such is something which is mysterious and calling for, let's say, a non-natural ultimate explanation. I know people like Plantinga would say this, but my feeling is, in the last couple of hundred years, we've made such advances on the understanding of the mechanics of life that I'm pretty much a Cartesian on this. I really do think at that level that we're machines.
Okay.
But I do think consciousness or sentience, I think, is a mystery, and I think that that's something that really calls for an understanding which transcends the purely natural. I mean, if you want to say, with Descartes, that sentience is, that you're a dualist, that it's a different kind of substance, fair enough, but where did it come from? If you're with Dan Dennett and you're an eliminativist, I have trouble with that word, and want to say that there's no such thing as consciousness, I think you're just crackers. I mean, just nuts.
Right.
It really does seem to me that without using heavy-duty words like miracle,
right,
I think that consciousness calls for an explanation. And more than that, of course, because consciousness isn't just consciousness. It's something which is tremendous. I mean, which, as Christians and other people like Augustine have long wanted to emphasize, that consciousness is to do with understanding, but it's also to do with morality and sociality and those sorts of things. So, you know, without
that's a really good start.
Phenomena.
Great.
Which demand explanation in some way. Now, it doesn't, I mean, I don't think, for instance, that makes you into a Quaker or a Mormon or something
but
like
that. But it leaves room for God.
It starts to push you in those sorts of directions.
Well, this is a great start, and it's been good to get some pushback both on the atheism that Randall is defending on today's show, and to hear your reasons that you could give for Christian theism. Michael, we're going to go to a short break and we'll be back. We're doing things very differently, though. Perhaps you've joined us sort of halfway through and you think, oh, Michael Roos, what a great Christian philosopher he is, and that Randall Rouser, he's obviously a very committed atheist. Well, no, quite the opposite. It's just we're doing a devil's advocate version of the show. Our Christian theologian is making the case for atheism. Our atheist philosopher, Michael.
Justin, you sound a lot more worried about this than we do.
I just don't want people to be too confused if they're tuning in halfway through.
That you're going to get into big trouble on this one, because we're just having fun.
It's great fun. It's great fun. In any case, do join us again on the other side of a short break, and we'll continue this debate, and we'll also make some time for going back into normal character, as it were, and finding out what we thought of it. So we'll be back in a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling
the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, there's light in the darkness. As we travel to the Middle East, Sam Hales reports firsthand on how Lebanon's Christian believers are bringing hope to Syria's Muslim refugees. There's also a theology focus. Discover four new doctrinal ideas being debated today, and a special interview with veteran evangelical scholar J.I. Packer. All that plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. We're doing something rather different on Unbelievable today. I'm describing this as the Devil's Advocate show, and I'll explain why again in a moment's time. Don't forget that as part of Faith Explored, Unbelievable brings you all kinds of conversations between different people every week. And you can go and explore our vast back catalogue of shows via the podcast, via the website and so on at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme as well a little later on in today's programme. You can find us online as well at the Facebook site and on Twitter at UnbelievableJB and facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to send me a message that way or catch up with what's been going on the programme recently. Well, today on the show, as I say, we're doing a devil's advocate version of the programme. Normally I'm joined for a debate, very often between a Christian and an atheist. That's true today, except they're swapping roles. So our Christian guest, our theologian Randall Rouser, is actually defending atheism today, what he thinks are some of the best arguments for atheism. And Michael Roos, being a great sport as an atheist philosopher, is actually attempting to defend theism today, and we've had a really interesting interaction so far. I hope it doesn't leave you too confused, but in any case, what we heard in that last section there, Randall, was a couple of arguments that Michael thinks, you know, give a good starter, if you like, for looking into theism. And those would be, why is there something rather than nothing? He's not at all convinced, even as an atheist, that other fellow atheists like Lawrence Krauss have in any way really answered this in terms of a physical explanation. And consciousness as well remains a great mystery and potentially a doorway to seeing that there may be some divine explanation. So what's your immediate response to those two arguments, Randall?
The question of does the universe require some reason for its existence? I agree that there is a powerful intuition here that it does. But the question is, what best explains that intuition? I think the answer is some sort of necessary cause. But I give a definition of God as follows. God is a necessarily existent, non-physical agent who is omniscient, omnipotent, and perfectly good. And I don't see how the intuition that the universe requires some explanation for its existence necessarily requires an agent, let alone one that is omniscient, omnipotent, or perfectly good. Now, on the second argument that is based on consciousness, well, I agree consciousness is something mysterious, but the argument I'm defending doesn't require taking a reductive view of consciousness. So, for example, one could take a Mysterian view, such as Colin McGinn, an atheist, does. He says, yes, this is mysterious. We don't know how to explain it. And it could arise from matter in a certain complex formation, but it's just part of the universe. We don't need to posit something even more extraordinary, like a necessarily existent physical non-physical agent to explain consciousness. Or another example, Galen Strawson, well-known naturalist, he argues for a panpsychic view. So the possibility that sentience or mind is a fundamental aspect of the world. So even small constituents of matter, whatever those basic units may be, perhaps an electron, could in some way be conscious. Now that sounds extraordinary, but is that any more extraordinary than 3-pound lump of gray matter between our ears having technicolor phenomenology? I don't find the invocation, again, of God, as I've defined, as providing any more of a satisfactory explanation than panpsychism or perhaps Colin McGinn's Mysterianism. So I just find these kinds of arguments underdetermining or not being directly supportive of theism such as it's been defined here.
Okay. What would you respond to that then, Michael?
Well, obviously, we're going to get into the argument, first of all. Since you've mentioned people like Strawson and others like this, we're clearly in the argument of whether or not this is a meaningful question. And I'm not quite sure how one answers to that one. I mean, I don't think that Wittgenstein gave us particularly powerful arguments for this. So I really do feel that the presumption is that this is a meaningful question. Now, you know, and I know, that if you just posit Yahweh, let's say, or the God of Michelangelo, who I like to describe God as somebody looking like Michael Roos in a bathrobe, it's not going to do the job. I mean, Richard Dawkins, bless him, realizes this, because then the question comes, what caused God? So the only kind of God that's going to be acceptable for somebody like me is going to be a God like the God of St. Augustine or the God of St. Thomas. In other words, I don't want to say, I don't even at this point necessarily want to say it's only the Christian God, but I do want to say it's got to be a God like the Christian God, in the sense that it does have to be something which is a necessary existent. What's it known as? A seity or something like that. Because anything other than that won't do the job. Loving, well, of course, you know and I know that we have to be careful about what we mean by loving, because loving is not necessarily, as I've tried to say earlier, giving you Clarence the Angel. I take it people know this reference. It's from Wonderful Life, where the man's about to commit suicide, and Clarence turns up and helps him. Mm. Well, as I say, I don't see a good God is necessarily one who's going to give us Clarence the Angel every evening, giving you life tips or something like that. So I think that, in a way, I'm almost forced into this position. And I take very seriously what Sherlock Holmes said to Dr. Watson. Watson, remember, when you have, eliminated all the impossibles, the improbable has to be true. So to a great extent, I'm taking my God almost as a God who's forced on me. I mean, that doesn't sound quite Christian, but I think it is. I think it's a very C.S. Lewis sort of position to take. I don't want to be a Christian. I've got no choice.
The most unwilling convert in all of England.
That is the kind of way I think I want to respond to Randall.
Yes. I mean, Randall, just reiterate again for me, for my benefit, what your fundamental objection was to the idea of why there is something rather than nothing, just so that I can make sure Michael's responded to that as well in that sense.
Well, I agree with Michael that any explanation, answer to that question needs to stop the chain of regress of asking questions of why. Mm. So I agree that it would have to be a necessary cause or one that exists a se. But the additional assumption that this cause would be an agent, so something that has a will, that has intentions or purposes, that looks, we would call it a person, let alone to add into that as well, that this agent must be, let's say, omniscient and perfectly good. I think that those are just additional suppositions that are not required. So I agree with the intuition. I agree that we may have to appeal to some kind of necessary cause. I don't think that we've established at all that it's an agent, and thus the cosmological argument here completely underdetermines that which we're trying to explain. It doesn't satisfy it, or it could, but many other explanations could as well. And those explanations are consistent with atheism.
Yes. So, Michael, your point being then that you do feel, if you're going to believe in God, it does have to be a God that has to exist.
Back, to a certain extent, to where I came in. Mm. And the fact that I can't give you an answer to everything, and I can't give you the whole thing pat, as it were, on a plate right now, doesn't mean that that my beliefs, my commitments are any less strong, because I do see this as, I do see religion, like everything else in this world, as developing. Right. So basically my position is as follows. I know that there has to be something there. I know that the only solution that will solve it is this necessary being. Almost, I mean, very much like the Platonic conception of the good. And, of course, that's where St. Augustine got most of his ideas, via Plotinus. Mm. So my position, to a certain extent, is I've got that. Now, you're right, Randall. How do I link the two, agency, these sorts of things? At one level, I want to say, even if I can't, I don't take this as a refutation. Now I see through a glass darkly, you know.
He's playing the mystery card. And,
I've heard that one before.
And so to a certain extent, I have to take things on faith. And, of course, this has always been part of the Christian tradition, that we don't know everything at this point, that we are ignorant of things, and there are things that we have to take on faith. So at one level, I want to say I do have to take these things on faith. At another level, I'm not quite sure that I think this, the situation is quite as awful as you're implying, because I do take the analogy of mathematics, which, of course, is where so much of this thinking comes. And what we see, obviously, is even if it isn't a causal agency, rather like, you know, a mum helping the child, and I realize these are metaphors we use, we do see that from the premises, a great deal follows. From very simple premises, and don't forget, my God is the ultimate simple, but we do see from very simple premises, very complex things emerge in some way. So my position would be, take my necessary being, and then in some, I know there has to be a connection, and the closest I can get in some sort of way is mathematical proof, which is, for me, quite a bit, because it does take me from very simple premises like, you know, the quickest way between two points is a straight line, to already fairly sophisticated conclusions like, you know, the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sums of the squares on the other two sides. Now, there's a connection there. It's not a simple causal connection, but at some level, from those simple premises, a great deal flows. And that I find a great help in my faith as I try to link the two up. But as I say, ultimately, I know one end of the answer is true. I know the other end of the answer is true. So I know there has to be a connection. And if I can't get it at the moment, then I take it on faith.
Yeah. Fascinating to hear you defending theism in that way, Michael. I think the other kind of area that Randall touched on briefly, and maybe you want to just reiterate it again for my sake, Randall, is the idea that consciousness admittedly is mysterious, but does it make sense to posit a whole other spiritual entity mind to explain it when we could just as easily?
Well, I think I'm on stronger grounds. I think I'm also on pretty confident grounds here. I mean, if Randall's right. I mean, why should 3 pounds of meat give rise to give rise to Shakespeare's plays, give rise to a Mozart symphony, give rise, you know, I'm tremendously fond of Donizetti, to Bel Canto opera. And, you know, at one level, it's a mystery. But it's more than a mystery, isn't it? It is something which anybody of any humility, and that's why Richard Dawkins can't do it, because Humble and Richard Dawkins, you know, don't go easily together, a bit like Bombs for Peace.
Okay.
But so I think anybody of any humility has to say, yeah, I can't answer this, but I know there has to be an answer. Now, what is the best answer that anybody has given? My answer is this creator being that I already am committed to, at some level, is trying to make us in his, hers, its image. And so, again, at one level it's mystery, but at another level it's not, because I know that I'm a thinker, at some level I know my Redeemer liveth.
I think we'll draw a line now under
I'm really getting you quite worried, aren't
I? No, not in the least.
You didn't expect me to be quite this Billy Graham.
Such a passionate Christian believer from Michael Roos. But
I think you might be in trouble. I think already your sponsors, you know, are saying when Justin calls, I'm not in.
No, it's been great fun. What I want to do is leave some space, you see, for us to, as I say, sort of talk about it once we go back into regular character, as it were. Let me just reiterate, though, if you're listening and you'd like to have your say, perhaps you've found this a fun, engaging debate where we've reversed the roles between Michael and Randall. Why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Equally, send me a message via Twitter or Facebook at unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or leave a comment underneath the latest show at the webpage. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today on the show, we've been encouraging my two guests, a Christian and an atheist, to swap roles, play devil's advocate, and make the case for atheism on the part of the Christian and for theism on the part of the atheist. How did you guys find that went? Randall, let's come to you first. What did you make, first of all, of Michael's defense of theism?
Well, of course, he didn't, when it came to my critique of biblical revelation, he advocated for a sort of setting aside the idea of revelation per se and talking more in terms of a natural human reflection on experience and developing theological categories out of that. And I guess the remaining challenge there would be to justify the conclusion that the reflection on that experience warrants some sort of knowledge about some supreme being. As regards his point on the cosmological argument, I think the question was still left unaddressed. Ultimately, he was appealing to faith to justify the conclusion that the necessary principle that explains the universe is an agent rather than not. And in terms of sentience, I think he was sort of still appealing to faith in a sense by saying a prior belief in God's existence will justify the conclusion that God is the origin of this consciousness, which is fair enough, but it doesn't address the fact that for an atheist who doesn't yet believe in God, they could appeal to a non-theistic explanation of consciousness, such as panpsychism or simply cognitive limitations of Colin McGinn's Mysterianism.
I mean, Michael also responded to you on the issue of evil and the indifference, apparently, of the universe, and that, well, this is what would be consistent in his view with a Christian view, that it is part of God's process, I suppose, of making us into the people he wants us to be and so on. What do you make of that?
Well, at this point, the question is, how much evil does there have to be before the soul-making explanation becomes implausible? So imagine, for example, a person is swept out to sea in a tsunami, and this provides the opportunity for another person to swim out, risk their own life, and save them. And through that experience, the one person develops courage and altruism and sympathy. The other person develops trust and compassion or whatever. Okay, I get that. But if we have the 2004 tsunami, December 26th, that sweeps 227,000 people into the ocean. You have to ask the question, is that degree of carnage really necessary to provide the kind of soul making that this deity wants? And a person could reasonably be skeptical of that claim.
That it becomes gratuitous at some level. What did you make of Randall's ways in which he attempted to show that atheism is true?
First thing is, I want to say, unlike Randall, I'm a Protestant. I may personally be a non-believer, but I'm a very Protestant non-believer.
Yes.
And I want to say that I am very distrustful of natural theology. I belong very much in the sort of Luther, Kierkegaard, Barth tradition, in the sense that ultimately, for me, faith, not only is natural theology doesn't work, but somehow it's misguided, because it seems to me it's trying to undermine the essence of faith, which requires commitment, and the leap into the absurd. So I would want to defend my theism very strongly in that sort of way. Now, I agree with Randall about the tsunami. I mean, why that should be allowed to happen. But I think that he's got a wrong conception of what my God can do. To be omnipotent, I don't think, unlike Descartes, does not mean you can make 2 + 2 = 5. And I think that if God is going to create the kind of world which he has created, I keep saying he, she, it has created, then it's going to have to be a world like ours where bad things like the tsunami do happen. It goes back to Clarence all the time. If Clarence could just turn up and stop the tsunami after 10 people had been killed, it would be a very different world from the one that we've got. All we can do, all I can do as a believer, is say that God recognizes these, and he loves the ones who are being swept out to sea just as much as he loves the ones who are left behind, or the ones who, you know, become ennobled through helping others, or something like that. And ultimately, God at the day of judgment is going to deal with these issues, and that's what being making this leap of faith means. It's very much like, you know, I follow Jesus in this. I mean, Jesus on the cross. I think that Jesus really thought that God was going to intervene before he died, and that Jesus suddenly realized that wasn't going to happen, and that one just has to accept the awfulness of things, and into thy hands, O God, I commit my spirit. That, for me, is the essence of my Christianity.
Right.
I was a Quaker.
Well, I know.
it
sounds like we're all still...
I mean, you've got to understand, that's my Quaker heritage.
Yes, yeah.
It
goes very deep, evidently. And what's funny is we still seem to be in character. You know, in as much as it's hard to know whether it's Michael playing the Christian or it's Michael Roos the atheist, but who sort of feels himself to be a Christian in some ways, you know,
I think
talking.
It's the latter. He really wants to be a Christian.
Well, look, just coming back to you, Randall, what I would be interested in hearing from you, though, is had you been in Michael's shoes and hearing that objection about the nature of God from Scripture, that Yahweh doesn't seem to have a good record in some ways. I know this is an area you've spent quite a long time yourself writing about and coming up with a certain viewpoint on that. Do you want to just quickly delineate that and how you, as a Christian this time, would respond to that objection?
Well, I will say that so-called biblical atrocities, they're great cards to play in a debate because you don't have a lot of time to provide people with a more nuanced understanding of biblical texts and how they function. So it's easy just to pull verses out of context. Let me put it like this. So if you have a text and you have certain readers read that text and they come away thinking it seems to have inconsistent plotting and underdeveloped themes and flat characters, this wasn't written by a great author. There's another group of readers who interpret those same apparent problems with the text as having certain nuances that justify them and explain their rationale within the text. Then you could have two different readers coming to the text, one dismissing it, the other finding something profound there. And I think that's often what you have with Scripture, that the Christian reading community throughout the last 2,000 years has been finding profound things in that text, whereas many more casual readers might dismiss it out of hand. So just to give one example, when you have the imprecatory Psalms, many of them, they talk about God's hatred of enemies. Or take one, Psalm 137 talks about wanting to dash Babylonian babies against the rocks. People can proof text that and say, what a horrible text. But the question is, how is that text functioning within the broader canon of Scripture? And I think some of the ways people have read those texts is they're not commending. Certainly, I wouldn't read them as commending that behavior. I would read them as sort of a cathartic venting. But also, if we read them in light of the revelation of God and Jesus, we're not called to hate our enemies. We're called to love our enemies. And so I would say Psalm 137 shows that we can identify with alienation and anger and the feelings of the desire for vindication. But we also need to move beyond that in light of Christ and reading that context with that text within the whole of Scripture. We're called to love our enemies. So I think it really requires a commitment, a respect to the text, to submit to it, to try to understand what's going on. And if people do that, they will find the Christian tradition has a long history of exploring different readings of these texts.
Yeah. I know, for instance, that you have disagreed with some other apologists' ways of dealing with the issue of Old Testament violence and so on. And you've got plenty of material on your blog if people wanted to investigate your approach to that a bit further. But it's been a really interesting exercise in this way. Michael, have you appreciated sort of being able to let your Christian side loose on the program today?
Well, yes, I have. I think the interesting thing, in fact, I was saying to a student earlier on today, who incidentally is a very keen follower of this, your blogs and everything like that, that, that what surprises me at 75, I really thought when I was 25 I'd be back on the Christian bandwagon at 70. What I find very interesting at 75 is I'm not. That I'm truly, you know, I really, truly, that's not just not where I'm at. So at one level, whatever I say, don't ever think that what you're hearing is somebody yearning to be a Christian.
Okay.
What you're hearing is somebody who is deeply appreciative of his Christian childhood. It was not something I gave to my children, and in certain respects, I rather regret that. I mean, I do think that I was able to give to my children a lot of the philosophy and discussion and those sorts of things. And I think, for instance, I'm tremendously proud of the fact that, you know, one of my children is a public defender, another's a school teacher, a third's an emergency medic. So, you know, I really do think they've got the Christian message. But for me, Christianity has always been, you know, love-hate is that sweet and sour, let's use that phrase, because love-hate means, you know, more of a conflict.
Yeah.
And I'm not conflicted about my Christianity. I'm certainly conflicted about creationism or intelligent design theory, but that's a different matter, because that was never Christianity for me. So for me, as I go off into the great unknown, as I say, I'm deeply appreciative of my Christian background, without in any sense wanting to buy on. You know, was it Thomas Henry Huxley said, I'm an intentionally religious person without any of the theology, or something along those lines.
We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll have the very final thoughts from both of you as we conclude today's experiment. We've been having a devil's advocate show on Unbelievable today. Michael Roos, philosopher of science at Florida State University. He's an atheist, but he's been playing the role of the Christian sort of apologist today, really. And Randall Rouser, a theologian, similarly playing the atheist debater on the programme. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be getting final thoughts from both my guests on the final part of today's edition of Unbelievable. Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley. And on Unbelievable today, we've got a devil's advocate edition of the programme. We'll be finishing up with my guests, Michael Roos and Randall Rouser, in a moment's time. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that Unbelievable and Faith Explored here on Premier is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. Get the latest mag available now if you want to go and look at it on the website or ask for a free sample copy. Can I recommend as well the profile in the magazine, J.I. Packer, who is a veteran evangelical theologian. He talks to Krish Kandaya in the latest edition of the magazine. That's up on our website, premierchristianity.com. In fact, it was recently announced that he's retiring from teaching and speaking due to increasing problems with his sight and hearing and so on. So a very timely edition of the profile in the magazine, in which you can read about his life and faith and the enormous influence he's had. So that's at the website, premierchristianity.com. If you want to read it in the latest edition of the magazine, why not simply ask for a free sample copy by adding to that web address /free sample. In any case, there's loads of other stuff as well in the latest magazine. Going to be bringing you details as well shortly about the next Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic discussion group happening in London on Monday, February the 8th. And of course, we'll be hearing a lot of your feedback as well to last week's programme on whether gay marriage is bad for children. Bobby Lopez and James Croft and a young Jacob Clark joined me for that show. And a little later on, between 4 and 5, Sam Hales is here for the profile, speaking to author Amy Boucher Pye about being an American adapting to life in the UK as a vicar's wife, and something she describes in her latest book. Right now, time to finish up today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been great fun having Michael Roos and Randall Rouser join me for today's show. If you've got any thoughts about it, I look forward to reading them as well. If you want to send those in via email, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. As I say, if you had tuned in halfway through the programme, you may have thought that you were hearing Michael Roos having undergone an extraordinary conversion at 75 to defending Christianity, and Randall going in the opposite direction. But we were sort of playing the devil's advocate in each case. And Randall, Michael sort of explained there that at the age of 75, he finds himself happy not being a Christian, appreciative of the, if you like, the upbringing that instilled a certain sense of the Christian virtues and values and so on in him, and obviously in no way despising those who do hold to a Christian faith. What did you learn in the course of today's program? And I suppose I would ask you, Randall, do you feel like you could still be convinced that it's not true and become an atheist? What do you say to that?
Who knows? I don't anticipate that. I've actually never really been the kind of person who had doubts about the deepest core of my beliefs. I've changed all sorts of things that I would take to be on the periphery. But, you know, who knows? I think that keeping an open mind and taking in evidence as it comes is part of the human experience. You know, last year, Michael Shermer, or in 2014, Michael Shermer, who's this famous skeptic, and he's always very dismissive of the supernatural and so on. He wrote an article in Scientific American called Anomalous Events That Can Shake One's Skepticism to the Core. And he reflected on this very mysterious experience he had where the day he was getting married, they had an old radio that hadn't worked for years, and his new wife, it was her radio that her grandfather had given her, and during the wedding ceremony, it suddenly starts playing. And he didn't have a framework to explain that. And that's just a reminder that for every one of us, new experiences can come down the road. They're going to shape our beliefs and maybe shake our worldview. And we need to be open, whatever our starting point, to keeping an open mind and processing that new experience as we pursue truth.
And do you find that this was a helpful sort of experiment to undertake? What did you get out of being able to unleash your inner atheist in today's program, Randall?
I think that it's a great example of what we need more of today, which is irenic, open-minded, charitable discussion across deep ideological divides. I think increasingly in North America and Europe, I'm kind of disheartened, if not afraid, of some of the trends I see to marginalize, stigmatize other groups, to label them. And so I think this has just been a great reminder that we need to try to get in the mind again of another person. And I will say, in advance of this show, I let some of my blog readers know about it, and everyone was delighted that Michael Roos was participating, because we all look at him as an exemplar on the other side for exactly that kind of charitable, fair-minded engagement. So it's been great.
Yes, it doesn't always go down well with other atheists, does it, Michael? Who perhaps feel you give too much ground. I don't know.
I find myself in this very strange position of being disliked far more intensely by my fellow atheists than by my, if I use the word Christian, opponents.
Right.
I hope it'd be understood in the sense of which it's taken. I mean, even, you know, people like Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish, I had very warm and friendly relationships with. Unlike, you know, my feelings about, or my relationship with Lawrence Krauss and with Richard Dawkins. I get on well with Dan Dennett.
Okay. Well,
but I mean, these are the things, and I think one of the things that I would like your listeners to go away with is to ask themselves, if assuming that they are believers, what is their belief? I mean, to what extent is, you know, how many, you know, how did Mr. and Mrs. Noah deal with elephant poo on the ark? Part of their actual beliefs, or to what, or where, what is the essence of their Christianity? And
yes,
I think you know, discussions like this can be very helpful as you've got to defend your the other position and see what you feel, you know, is defensible, and what you basically say, well, that's, you know, I don't know, but that's just not central to my belief. And I think Randall was saying this. He's saying, you know, there are lots of things I've changed, but they've never been part of my central belief. And I think the important thing is to say, what is your central belief? My central belief is, I'm not a humanist. I hate humanists.
Right.
Or I hate humanism.
Yes.
But I do think it's, for me, the Quaker idea of that, a God in every person, I take it in a secular sense, is absolutely central to my, should we call it, my religious beliefs.
Yeah. Well, it's been really, really interesting. Thank you both for coming on today. I know that in a way your most recent book, Randall, sort of touches on this whole area of being empathetic and putting yourself in the other person's shoes. That was Is the Atheist My Neighbor? And sort of...
Well, and Justin, when you get the sack for putting on this program, I'll be happy to write a letter of support to
Well,
the next
thank
job,
you
okay?
very much. Thank you. I will put you on my CV as a reference, Michael. but it's been great fun. Do go and check out both Michael and Randall's websites. Michael, you can simply Google and you'll find Michael Roos popping up on Wikipedia and elsewhere. Randall Rouser, you can go to his website at randallrouser.com. I look forward to probably having you both on again at some point in the future. But for the moment, it's been great fun doing this Devil's Advocate show. And all the very best, Michael and Randall.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks to everyone who has been in touch. I'm going to give the ways to get in touch again in a moment's time. And we'll be hearing what you had to say about last week's programme where we asked, is gay marriage bad for children? Quick reminder that the Unbelievable Christian Skeptic Discussion Group continues its monthly meeting on Monday, February the 8th. And the title for the discussion this time is The Road to Monotheism. They'll be meeting again at the William the Fourth Pub, 7 Shepherdess Walk in London. The details are all available on the meetup.com website. And it's hosted by atheists and Christians who listen to Unbelievable. Not something I have a hand in at all, really. Very much developed organically from the show. So what's the topic? The Road to Monotheism. Well, here's from the description. Belief in the divine is widespread across many cultures, and this may be because the belief reflects reality. An atheist thus needs to explain why, from their perspective, belief in the divine has arisen erroneously. Well, the speaker, Alan Duval, will illustrate how one very important social cognitive skill gives rise to empathy and thus morality. And from that, he'll seek to explain the experience of the divine as an attempt to grapple with the moral problems of an increasingly large social environment. So Alan sees a logical progression from animist and ancestor spirit religions through anthropomorphized animal gods, pantheons, and finally the road ends at monotheism. And his claim will be that everything needed to create the rich narratives associated with the God of the Bible is the human skill of empathy allied with human culture. So Alan's from New Zealand. He's a graduate in psychology, and he's moving on to a PhD. And so I'm sure that'll be a very interesting presentation by Alan for an atheist perspective on why monotheism has arisen. And then, of course, there'll be the usual discussion that takes place afterwards. The group will split into smaller groups, round tables, and that's where the real fun is had, as well as doing it over a drink, of course. So if you want more details, it's at the meetup.com website, happening Monday, February the 8th. Now, we've had lots of response to last week's programme, and again, if you want to respond to today's show, you're welcome to do that via email. It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want to get in touch and leave me your thoughts via the Facebook or Twitter account, that's great as well, at unbelievablejb, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, to follow the show on either of those social media networks. What you're going to hear is a combination of emails and things that have come in via Facebook and on the actual website as well, where you can leave your comments underneath the latest programme. So what happened last week? Well, it was Bobby Lopez, who's a campaigner for the rights of children to be raised by their biological mother and father. And he says that gay parenting is taking away that right for children. In some cases, if you like, expunging one of the biological parents from the birth records and things like that. Children are effectively being born to be raised by same-sex couples, and he believes that's transgressing a moral right of children. And there was an interesting debate between him and James Croft also, who was our atheist gay representative on the programme last week, on whether studies in this area show that gay parenting is worse for children than heterosexual parenting. And we had Jacob Clark, who himself had been fostered for the last couple of years as a teenager by a gay couple. So really interesting debate. But one thing that a few people have spotted, Daniel in particular, said, problem with the latest podcast. It cut out during the feedback from Victor from Hungary at the 1 hour, 16 and 49 seconds mark. The show's normally over 1 hour, 20 minutes. I hope the missing minutes can be found. Yes, that was noted by a few people. Daniel, apologies that the audio was slightly short, cut slightly short for some reason, not sure why, on the latest podcast. We are in the process, as I speak, of uploading the full audio, so you can hear the last few minutes of the show. You didn't miss much. It was mainly just me flagging ahead to next week's programme and so on. That should be there if you do a fresh download on your podcast of the programme. So turning to the topic under discussion itself, Jason Vondero said, I guess I'll start by saying that though you don't do it very often, I always find your two-on-one shows a little confusing. First of all, in a debate format, it doesn't seem very fair to have one person defending himself against two others. Someone always ends up dogpiled in these scenarios. Second of all, when it isn't a pile on, someone always ends up taking a back seat. I'm sure Jacob Clark is a nice guy, but he offered nothing to the show. As for the debaters themselves, Bobby Lopez had some interesting thoughts on the subject, but he didn't seem that prepared, and that hurt his case. I suppose I'm spoiled by listening to debaters like William Lane Craig, where when asked to produce a study, he's able to produce the exact name, authors, page numbers and footnotes, as though he had it in his back pocket. Lopez maybe could have made his case stronger if he had all his material in front of him and anticipated some of the questions coming from Croft. Croft seemed like the more practiced debater, but his occasional habit of talking through both of you and Lopez was a bit aggravating and confusing. Anyway, those are the thoughts from Jason. Well, we do sometimes do two on one side and one on the other. What I always aim to make sure is that both sides get an equal amount, though, in terms of the pro and anti side in that sense. Because sometimes there is a case for having someone like Jacob, who obviously didn't contribute as much as the other guests, but what I wanted him there to sort of bring personal experience into the discussion as well. I thought it was a helpful contribution at the times he did come on. Appreciate, though it could look a bit one-sided sometimes. David says, shouldn't there have been someone representing the or a Christian point of view? A bit of religion, maybe even the Bible, could have come in handy to leaven this discussion. For instance, an evangelical or Catholic spokesperson saying that same-sex families are contrary to the plan and will of God for humanity. It was a rather glaring omission, I thought. As it was one, personal experience, two, I think, and three, studies show, oh no, they don't, oh yes, they do. Appreciate that commentary, David. I mean, it wasn't stated explicitly in the programme, but Bobby Lopez himself is a Christian. But I think the point being that he wanted to put it on a more sociological footing. He wasn't making his arguments from Scripture and the Bible in that sense. He was wanting to make the argument against gay parenting purely from the sociological and human rights perspective. And I think that's okay to do sometimes, because, of course, you know, leaving people to join the dots in terms of the religious implications sometimes. Thomas B. Yee says, quick comment, there seemed to be quite a lot of interruptions, both between the guests, particularly Lopez and Croft, and between you and the guests. It didn't seem like one speaker or the other was being favoured or cut off more frequently than the other, but it made for a feisty debate, sometimes bordering on disrespectful. There were several times I really wanted to hear one speaker finish what they had started to say. This isn't directly related to the arguments and evidence being discussed on the show, but I was pondering what a Christian response should be to the question under debate, and I had a realization. For those who share a Christian worldview as a foundation, consider that raising a child in a same-sex household bears on Jesus's and Exodus's command to honour one's father and mother. This is especially true when one's birth parents are removed from the birth certificate. While it would still be possible to carry out the commandment for one's birth parents, the opportunity to do so would be greatly limited. Thanks, Justin. Thank you, Thomas. Adelaide says, I've been listening to the show for 3 years. The last show between Bobby Lopez and James Croft struck a chord with me. I am both in a gay relationship and an atheist, but I completely agree with Bobby. James Croft's thinly veiled jabs at Bobby about being homophobic made me cringe. James made the conversation almost useless with excessive political correctness. In regards to the topic, I'm firmly against homosexual adoption for a simple reason. Heterosexual is preferable. It's almost unimaginable to me that a person would hold up a single parent as being equal to a mother-father home, and similarly with a homosexual versus heterosexual. I think a homosexual home is similar to a single parent household in that it lacks a family member. James seems to be repulsed that children are seen as straight until proven otherwise. However, I think that's absurd. I wasn't raised as either gay or straight, and to put these labels on children is appalling. I have much more to say, but I've tried to be as brief as possible. Thank you very much, Adelaide, and a very interesting perspective, obviously, from yourself, but perhaps not one people would be expecting from a gay atheist, but there you go. This from Kenneth says, big fan of the show. I'm currently working on my PhD in sociology, and my ears perked up when your guest discussed the field and the Regnerus controversy. And just to fill you in, if you haven't listened to last week's show, he was one of the researchers that Bobby was talking about, whose research seems to indicate that children do less well in homosexual single parent households than heterosexual ones. Anyway, you say, I mostly focus on religious persecution, freedom and restrictions, but I've got a broad interest in the sociology of religion and am acquainted with Regnerus's work. Regnerus was criticised for not accurately measuring parents in a gay marriage. It's true that he didn't do that, but this is also a straw man argument. He's clear that his study focuses on individuals who report having a parent who has engaged in homosexual activity with some people. Regnerus explicitly stated that his study does not evaluate the offspring of gay marriages, since the vast majority of its respondents came of age prior to the legalization of gay marriage in several states. He was also clear that his study was cross-sectional, not longitudinal, could not establish causation, and did not have any political ramifications regarding same-sex relationships. The sample that Regnerus utilized has been criticized as non-random and non-representative. This may or may not be true and is worth discussing, but it's also worth noting that studies with less reliable samples are uncontroversially published in reputable journals on a regular basis. To address your guest's concern that he was not comparing apples to apples, when Regnerus compared the offspring of parents who had engaged in homosexual activity with offspring who did not report this of their parents, he did control for race, ethnicity, age, gender, mother's education, perceived family of origin, income, and whether or not the respondent had been bullied. The study was not perfect, but I've yet to see one that is. The backlash Regnerus faced was unique, but the weaknesses of his study were not. Christian Smith, a prominent sociologist, has determined that the backlash Regnerus faced represented a blatant double standard of methodological and political criticism, very selectively condemning Regnerus but never applied to any other scholarly research publication on the same topic, despite their typically relying on much weaker samples and analytic methods. I myself have been subjected to ridicule and flippant dismissal for being an evangelical Christian without conforming to political views. I'm not complaining at all. My beliefs have been tried by fire. I feel sorry for those on the other side who have not been forced to engage in the kind of critical thinking that they have imposed on me. Very interesting. Thank you, Kenneth, for bringing a bit of your perspective on that, those particular studies, and that one in particular. Jake is a youth pastor from Portland, Oregon. Says, I'm a first-time emailer. Felt I should finally write in after avidly listening for about 2 years. Your podcast has been a great help to me, and I appreciate the team's hard work at booking quality guests on important issues. I just finished listening to your latest show, Is Gay Marriage Bad for Children? Props to you for booking a young man like Jacob Clark to get his perspective on the issue. I thought he was well composed and made good contributions to the conversation. Thank you for the hard work you all do. Matt Rubenstein is another regular listener and says, if there were ever a poster child for the supposed psychological dangers of gay parenting, it would surely be your homophobic guest this week, Bobby Lopez. I've yet to hear a more petulant, intemperate debater on your show. With all due respect, though, I'm afraid that the second worst participant on this show was you. You let Lopez interrupt the other guest at almost every opportunity, such that James Croft could barely finish a train of argument. Normally, you really are an excellent referee in these discussions, but this time I feel you just didn't do your job, Justin. As for Bobby Lopez, his arguments boil down to the usual technique of religious moralising, which is to assume the thing you're supposed to prove. Declaring it a right to be raised by your biological parents is called arguing by definitional fiat, and it only convinces those who aren't inclined to probe beyond the declaration. If Bobby Lopez showed anything, it's that you can dress up the ugly face of prejudice in all the pseudo-sociological science in the world, and all you get in the end is a Neanderthal in drag. Thank you, Matt. And apologies if you thought my refereeing was not fair on this occasion. It's difficult when you've got two obviously passionate guests sometimes to make sure that everyone gets their fair say. But anyway, this from Gary, who was a participant in the Atheist Prayer Experiment episode a few years ago, says, just a few thoughts on the latest show. Lopez's claim that every child has a right to be raised by their biological parents would apply to adoption in general, not just same-sex couple adoptions. Lopez's argument regarding human trafficking and baby factories applies equally to heterosexual couples adopting. Lopez's argument that heterosexual couples provide gender diversity would apply equally well to single parent situations, whether arising from death, divorce, or adoption. And Lopez's claim that social science research is unreliable and can't be reproduced undermines his own claim that social science research shows that children raised by same-sex couples are at a disadvantage. Michael says, thank you for an energetic episode. It's not clear whether or not Bobby Lopez was supposed to be the Christian guest on this week's show. It wasn't stated in his case. While James Cross was described as a humanist, and only the affable Jacob Clark professed his Christianity. If so, it would be interesting to know if Bobby's views on the propriety of same-sex couples raising adopted children changed after a conversion experience, or is informed by evangelical theological leanings. As James pointed out, the concerns Bobby has about the potential limitations implications of being raised by two gay adoptive parents would seem to accrue to ugly divorce degrees, custodial kidnapping, single parenting, and being orphaned as well, if not more so. Children and adults can be traumatized by issues arising from abuse, divorce, custody, surrogacy, single parenting, foster care, and adoption, quite without regard to the sexuality of the couple raising a child. In any case, I hope all involved strive to help create young people who are as well adjusted as young Jacob, who took part. Lots of comments in the comment section underneath the show online. Lots of people criticising Bobby Lopez on that. Here's one from Justin P, who says Lopez remains completely inconsistent in his relation to sociological research, and gives a few reasons why he felt that, and also concerned that Lopez never offers a defence of his central argument vis-a-vis rights, as Croft noted. Lopez attempted to wave this fact off with broad ad hominems and with an appeal to his own authority. And your third concern is that Lopez's only argument appeals to completely stand upon frankly sexist gender stereotypes. Men cannot teach their children sympathy or how to make greeting cards. Women can't teach their children strength and assertiveness. This is nothing but the most banal and uninteresting sexism. But there were a number of commenters supporting Bobby's perspective. Mary Sum said, if relationships are a civil right, why does a child have to give up a relationship with his biological mother or father if it gets in the way of a gay relationship? Complete hypocrisy. And another said, who is James Croft to say that I was not entitled to be raised by my biological parents? What a truly sick and disordered person. And he's a child developmental specialist. How are men and women different? How do we even count the ways? How could a serious thinking person even dispute the idea that men and women are different? Men and women view the world differently, have different experiences. Just the fact alone that men don't get their periods mean that girls would be at a disadvantage in the biologically impossible two dads situation. Steve Wilkinson said, a very good discussion, thought Bobby did a great job, except he missed getting in a critical point when James made the parallel with a divorced single parent. Well, when we're talking about single parents, that is a situation which hopefully isn't that way by design. But with a gay or lesbian couple, it is by design, depriving the children of a mum or dad. Divorce also does the same, but doesn't set out to be that way from the start. And hopefully we're discouraging divorce as something we'd like not to see to be the case. Regarding the studies, while I'm sure any study can be shown to have flaws, I always find it interesting that the primary argument against Regnerus and a couple of other studies with meaningful levels of data are dismissed because of who did the study, i.e. a genetic fallacy, while the multitude of studies, which are quite obviously flawed, the APA, etc., used in coming to their decisions are put forward as the scientific consensus and the end of the story. Okay, and another person says the move to exclude Mr. Lopez from discourse is a good example of an increasingly common expression of a utopian will to power. It reminds me of Newspeak. There's no real engagement with Mr. Lopez here, but rather a preformed judgment from which he is then interpreted. And you give an example of this Newspeak by Roger Scruton. But anyway, lots of interesting comments, both back and forth, pro and anti Bobby and James in the comment section underneath the latest show. If you want to check them out for yourself and listen back to that programme from last week, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, we're all out of time for this week's edition of Unbelievable. Thank you for being with me, and do join me again at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, next week's show is still in the making, and we're hopefully going to be doing a discussion on whether Christians are happier than atheists. And, well, we'll see where that lands, because, as I say, I'm still working on that one. But tune in next week from 2:30 or listen via the podcast, and you'll hear something very interesting, I'm sure. In the meantime, thanks for being with me today. I'm handing over now to Sam Hales on The Profile.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.